accession number 4608, reel number 7.
I can't remember what I was talking about.
Air Marshal Sir Victor Groom, Reel 7. Did the RAF personnel realise that the change in tactic was occurring, of holding down Iraq by the RAF alone, as opposed to the...
Well, certainly at my age and in my position, I had very little idea of what was going on, or of the policy that was adopted at that time. I think it was Winston Churchill was responsible for it, wasn't he? Letting the Air Force eventually take over control. But of course, I think it had tremendous advantages, and I perhaps say this with hindsight rather than did I realize it at the time, because the army, wherever they went, had enormous amount of impedimenta. Their columns and everything, horses, wagons, lorries, have it what you will, were always fair game for attacked by the natives, whether it was in India on the frontier or whether it was the Arabs in Iraq or the Kurds in Kurdistan. And the Air Force, by making life intolerable for the people out in the villages and places, not by killing them, but by just driving them out of their villages and making them live under awkward conditions and where they couldn't tend their flocks. Certainly, I think we were able to do that in limited areas without affecting the whole population. If you occupy a country, as Russia's just done in Afghanistan, and you have your troops everywhere, this is bound to stir up enormous troubles with the local population. The Air Force could control the outlying spots by affecting only the places where there was trouble. If, during that period of occupation of Iraq, there had been trouble in a city like Baghdad, really serious trouble, the Air Force could never have dealt with it. We could only deal with it by driving people out of their villages. And after all, what was the troubles? The trouble was either that they were doing local murders or that they were refusing to pay their taxes. This doesn't happen in large cities in the ordinary way, and the civil police can compete with it. So where our advantage was in Iraq was in the outlying areas and keeping place, which would have taken enormous numbers of troops to be able to do it, vast expense, and by upsetting the local population, which the airplanes didn't do, and we kept to ourselves.
Well, what was the role of the British presence in Iraq? Was it strategic? Was it imperial development?
I think you've asked the wrong man, because I tell you, as a young officer in the Air Force, I haven't the foggiest idea. We were there, young officers, just doing what we were told in those days. Looking back on it, as I say, with more hindsight, one knows that the oil potential was realized. Even when I was at Kirkuk, well, the oil was oozing out of the ground through the sand. It was as obvious as that. And, of course, after all, we just turned Turkey out, you see. Mesopotamia was run by Turkey before the First War. And you can't just leave it. This country had to learn to grow as a nation. We put the first king on the throne, Faisal, in Baghdad, you mustn't forget. And they hadn't really got a government of their own. They hadn't learnt to govern. And after all, then they were having trouble with the Kurds, which we took on for them. After all, when we were in Mosul, we were looking after keeping the Kurds in order more than the Arabs. We were helping the Arabs in this sense. Oh, no, I don't think in those days there was... It was only later, when the national spirit had been built up in Iraq, that the Arabs really objected to us. The insurrection in Iraq when we were there was just because they just didn't like soldiers being in the place anyway, and they'd been through this war between us and the Turks anyway, and that was all they were after. They were just getting free in their villages. In the central areas in Baghdad, there was no trouble.
Did you keep in contact with home whilst you were in Iraq?
Well, the only contact one had was a letter which arrived. It took about at least a month, if not longer, to come to you. And this was the only way one was able to communicate. And it took a long, long time. I remember, for instance, my first wife at that time. I'd been very attached to her before I left England. We weren't engaged or anything of that sort. But I did have a tenuous correspondence with her at that time, because she was young as I was. But it was a hell of a long time between letters. It wasn't till later on, when I'd got to India I went out to India in 1928, 29, that one was able to get correspondence more quickly. Everything from Iraq in those days had to go to India before it came back to England. And it was a very long, tenuous route for letters. And I've got no collection of letters. When I was in India, I've got long letters which I described everything to my parents, and afterwards when my wife was at home to my wife, describing the conditions and the way one was living and everything. But I've got nothing of the Iraq days. I never kept anything. I was a very bad correspondent. Just the same as I've never written a book, and I've never written my experiences. I'm too lazy, I think.
What about newspapers? Did newspapers reach you?
Oh, yes, but the mess, we used to get a whole lot of newspapers at once, probably at least a week. There weren't any airmail editions, you mustn't forget, or anything like that. There was a local paper produced by the British forces in Baghdad. I can't remember what it was called, but there was a sheet of some sort produced. And of course there was no wireless to listen to or anything of that sort. Communication were pretty bad altogether. But I know one chap who had the Morning Post sent to him while we were in Egypt, for instance, and he used to get a week's supply. And on a Monday, he would open the Mondays of that supply, and he wouldn't look at the others until the appropriate day. This chap dead now, a chap named Hood, Bernard Hood. But he always did that. He waited until the day to read his paper. And he was a month behind, or 3 weeks behind with the news, but he was reading Monday's paper on a Monday.